Yes.
What about spot, you said the diocese contact the other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
If the reason they're separated is a spousal route, and one is on the run from the other, do you think they take that into consideration? Because maybe they don't want to let the patient first know where.
And their location would never need to be revealed. I mean, if someone's on the run, the question is if the spouse, the other party, if there was abuse involved and they're kind of on the run and they don't want to reveal their identity, this does not reveal their identity. If you and I were married and I was abusing you and you were on the run and you wanted to get an annulment and you went to the church, all I would get is a phone call that, you want to get this annulled, and they would say, do you want to participate? Do you have anything that you want to say about this particular marriage? And I could say yes or no, and if I do, they would interview me. They do all the witness testimonies separately, privately. So again, it's not like we'd ever be brought together into a real courtroom. So, and even if I said, you tell me where she is, they can't. It's all under the seal of confession too, number one. It's all considered very very secret and very private, because a lot of personal details, of course, are going to be involved just necessarily. And so something like an identity would never be, or a location would never be revealed.
Who has access to their annulment file?
As far as I know, the person getting the annulment.
So the other party of the marriage, do they have access to the file?
They I don't know the exact, I'm not a canon lawyer, and I don't know the particular procedures of this diocese. They would never reveal anything that could be detrimental to the other person. They would let them know, this is what this person has said. They might not give them the actual testimony or whatnot. But again, all of this eventually comes before a judge in the form of various written testimonies and whatnot, and sometimes psychological evaluations and all sorts of other things that are kind of brought before the judge, who then really looks. And then all of the cases, number one, that have to go to a court of appeals, which is done in a different diocese, and then finally, if it gets appealed even further, it can go to Rome, and then there's a court of appeals at Rome. But it's, I don't know exactly what one is able to look at, but they do keep everything pretty quiet, so they would never just say, here, this is what the other person turned in, tell us your side of the story, Yeah.
My question has a few parts to it. I guess the first one is, are there any statistics in the Archdiocese as to the number of annulments that are applied for and those that are not annulled?
Yes.
And you may not have that, but I guess my...
I don't have Washington, but I know in the United States, and actually this was in here, let's see, in 2007, about 70% of the annulments requested were granted.
Okay.
Which is kind of sad, but at the same time you also want to say, well, if they were truly invalid marriages, thank God, because now this person can kind of be at peace, they can get remarried, they can, from one perspective it's kind of sad, from another perspective it's kind of good. I don't know how you want to look at it.
Right. So the bigger question is, if pre-canon classes are designed to prepare the two to receive the sacrament of marriage, then is the Archdiocese looking at the reasons for annulments of those people, the application, and are they trying to look back into the pre-canon classes the things that are calls these people to get divorced? Because if I'm supposed to get with you 6 months prior to getting married and you go through the classes, it seems like it would be difficult to nullify that marriage between those two Catholics if you've already covered all the bases of those three things you just talked about. and then they got married. Because if they went into it, you know, with the, you know, intent of just that person and 20 years down the road or whatever, you know, they committed adultery or whatever,
mm-hmm.
it doesn't change the fact that at the time...
Oh, of course not.
I wouldn't think.
No.
So how does the Archdiocese reconcile that? Or how do they try to cut down on the number of divorces and annulments by, I guess, beefing up the pre-canon classes, you know, or the requirements that they need to do to get married?
Yeah. Well, this is why, I mean, when we do marriage prep, you know, we tell the couple up front that, like, I want to make sure, like, I've told the couple then, and I did this with my sisters, I said, like, I want your wedding to be valid. I don't want it to even be possible that in 20 years you would be able to look back at this and say, you know. So I asked them, and this is part of the, not just the pre-cana, but this is part of the basic paperwork that's done at your first meeting with a couple. You know, do you intend to enter a lifelong union that is exclusive, that is open to children, that, and they, yes, 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 yeah, and they're asked every possible formulation of this question. Now, again, the issue can always come up, well, 20 years ago I lied when I filled out the form. You know, I said yes, but I was lying, you know. Well, now this is the problem, is if they were actually lying, and if they did not intend to enter a lifelong union that was exclusive, that was open to children, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, if there was a no to any of those questions, even though they may have said yes, even though they may have signed the form, that doesn't prevent them from still lying. And then the issue becomes trying to figure out, well, did you lie? Or are you just trying to say now that you're lying so that you can get out of this? You know what I mean? Like... It's a problem though, because again, how would one deal with this if they say that they mean everything, and then, I mean, I guess the point I'm making is just to play devil's advocate to your question is nothing prevents someone from filling out all the paperwork, listening to all the classes, saying that they're going to do all these things, and then on the day of their wedding, actually having some kind of mental reservation that no one else knows about. You know, they might have it in the back of their mind that, well, I don't really intend this to be exclusive. As soon as the other person gets ugly, I'm going to hook up with someone else. I mean, if that's in there, if that is in there at all, then that invalidates it. And then the problem becomes, how do you prove what's inside someone's head?
Right.
And this is the problem, and this is why, you know, we don't just take their word. You know, this is why a lot of money comes on, is because you have to really investigate. You have to call up. That's why you're required to identify all sorts of people who we can talk to, your friends, your family, you know. Did you ever know so-and-so to be, you know, this kind of person? Would you know, if all of his friends say, oh, yeah, he was hooking up with people even up until the day before he was married, you know, well, maybe you didn't really mean that. Or if they come back and say, no, he was always so faithful and blah, 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 and I can't possibly imagine, you know. It's a matter of trying to get inside someone's head and see what their intention was. You know, and the problem is they could be lying to you now in the present when they're trying to get the annulment, or they could be lying to you at the altar 20 years ago, you know. But... again, because the problem is that what makes marriage is consent. Like I said in the beginning, consent makes marriage. And so if you are giving your consent, then it's there. And even if you come back later and say, oh, well, I was lying, well, that doesn't change it. But this is a good question, and it's the kind of thing that you, it really makes you think, like, how do we... And this is why it does take so much time to really try to get inside the person's head and try to figure out, did you actually intend this at the time, you know? And then being able to kind of prove that. But again, we assume validity until proven otherwise. Yeah.
Are all the judges from the diocese here, or are they separated judges from different dioceses that are located in D.C. at the same time
you mean like where they are?
Yeah, okay. You probably have three judges.
Well, sometimes it's three, sometimes it's one.
Okay, depends on the
Right. Well, if it's like lack of form, I mean, a single judge can look at that. That's just paperwork. That's not. Yeah.
All the judges actually from the Washington diocese, or they have to have other priests act as judges for the tribunal. So have to be across the hallway from different dioceses coming to D.C., and they're looking at the one judges. And do you have a general disciple as one of the
judges? I see what you're saying.
No matter what.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, that's why every single annulment has to be approved by the second court, so the second tribunal. So like, for instance, in the Archdiocese of Washington, our court of second instance is the Archdiocese of Cincinnati, I believe. So whenever we issue an annulment, automatically it goes to them, and their different judges look at it and determine the same thing. But no, I mean, our judges are... They don't have an interest in seeing this one way or the other. You know what I mean? They don't have, and that's why, for instance, even if the annulment is not granted, it still costs money, and they're still going to ask you to pay. You know, it's not like you pay if we grant the annulment. You know, it's a matter of, you know, if I'm a tribunal judge, my interest, and most of them are priests, not all of them though, because anyone can get a degree in canon law. In fact, the lady who taught canon law at my seminary has her doctorate in canon law. She used to be in the Protestant seminary, left the Protestant seminary before ordination, became Catholic, got her doctorate in scripture, and then went to Rome and got her doctorate in canon law, and is now the chancellor of the Diocese of Harrisburg and teaches canon law at the seminary. And she's a judge. But it's in the judge's interest to really look at the truth and say, again, is this valid or is this not valid? So when I see a case, my interest is just to see the bond respected. If there is a bond there, then you're still married, and sorry, you can't get remarried because you're married. And if there's not a bond there, then you're free to remarry. You're free to marry. So, I mean, it's not like, you know, all the judges of D.C. are going to vote one way and all the judges of another court are going to vote another way. You know, I mean, it's every judge is going to look at it themselves, and again, it's not, don't actually imagine a courtroom. It's not like the three of them are up there kind of debating amongst themselves. It's all done at a desk, you know, and it all comes across their desk, and they spend hours going over everything and making their decision. And then that's why it goes through a few different judges and then goes to a court of second instance before the decree is actually issued.
There has to be a universal agreement on part of the three judges?
You know, I think so. I could be wrong. I'd have to check that out. That's a good question. But, I mean, I suppose you could find, I mean, because then the issue comes, well, what if even just one judge, you know? So, yeah. They can never reapply on the same grounds. So, for instance, of those are the three different grounds I'm talking about: defective consent, impediment, or form, non-conform. Thank you. If it was presented as a case of impediment, and then the tribunal determines no, there was no impediment, and therefore it is still valid. Well, they could never again try to get that marriage annulled on the grounds of impediment, but they could try to go for form, for instance, or for consent. But no, once any tribunal anywhere in the world, and every single diocese in the entire universe, in the entire world, has a tribunal and does this. Every single diocese in the entire world has a tribunal and does this. And once any tribunal has investigated any marriage on any ground, that's it. And once it's been approved by the court of second instance. So,
outside of canonical form, how long, on average, does it take to put it on?
The amount of time that goes into it, and the amount of paperwork, a defective consent annulment can take up to a year and a half. Sometimes 6 months, sometimes up to a year and a half. A defective form, I've gotten that back in 2 weeks, because that's a matter of simply proving that you were a Catholic and therefore held to form, that you were not dispensed from form, and that you got married anyways, and so boom, it's invalid. And that, yeah, well, that's the thing is it can be a very long time, especially if the other person is fighting back, if the other person is maintaining that this is valid, you know, and one person saying no, it's not, and this is why not, and the other person saying yes, it is, and this is why it is, and this is why any couple can appeal directly to Rome. Any couple can say, I don't want to deal with the diocese anymore, and let it go to Rome, which is actually probably a bad idea because it's just going to take even longer. But they can do that. I mean, any couple can appeal to them. But and that's unfortunately it does take time. But understand, this is why the church is very careful with this, because you're dealing with people's lives, you're dealing with the sacrament, and we're trying to determine whether or not this bond is here, whether or not these people are actually married, and if they are. Then they can't get remarried, and if they're not, then they can. I mean, so it's a pretty big deal.
I'm curious with the separation and the suspension of form in particular.
Mm-hmm.
What happens? What are the what is in place to guard against a liberal priest who just kind of fudges things because he thinks, you know, well, it's better they get married than not. Rather than them going off and just living together or getting married by a justice of the peace, is it possible for a priest to fudge things if he...
Well, like fudge what, though?
Well, like, for instance, whether the couple intends to be open to children.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or, right.
Well, but one party being pregnant doesn't affect anything.
Well, what if he doesn't make him go, like, through the pre-canon class?
Right. Well, technically, all that has to be proven to do a wedding, all that has to be proven is that the couple is free to marry, that there is not an impediment, you have to prove that they're free to marry and they're able to, that they are ready, willing, and able to give consent, and that canonical form is observed. But that's why, I think I mentioned last time, in the little emergency pocket ritual that the priest would carry on him, the back flap actually has, like, marriage in an emergency. Like, if someone's on their deathbed dying, and they want to be married. Again, I don't totally understand why someone would want to do that, because the bond is broken as soon as the person dies anyways. But at least people say, well, we once were married. But so long as it can be proven, but...
suspending the canonical form.
Which has to go all to the diocese, so the priest can't dispense that.
Okay. And what goes into that?
Well, the priest fills out... I mean, when a couple comes to me and says, I want to get married, the first thing I do is I fill out a form for both of them. And I have to pull them apart separately. I have to ask one person questions, fill out the form, and then privately the other person fill out the form, and go through all this, and as it comes out that one of them is Catholic and one of them is not Catholic or whatever. Really what that means is, and I tell them this because I'm dealing with some couples right now that are going to require various dispensations, and I'll just tell them, you know, look, this is fine, we're going to be able to do this, but, you know, I will have to fill out this extra form and send it up to the diocese, and, you know, assuming there's not a problem, it comes back in a week or two, and we're good to go. So a lot of times the couple themselves doesn't even know that there is this extra form being filled out if the priest doesn't tell them. But,
so if a couple goes through with a priest and they believe everything is, you know, in order, they don't
No, I mean, it would be the couple nullifying it, but perhaps the priest's fault for not having told them what was required. So my job, for instance, is not necessarily to tell a couple that, by the way, you need to intend an exclusive union. Like, they should know that. Now, if I'm a good priest, I'm going to remind them of that in their marriage prep, that, by the way, you know that marriage is exclusive. But let's say I don't tell them that for one reason or another, because I don't want to bug them with it or because I just forget or whatever. It's still on them to intend what one is supposed to intend to get married. It's still on them to intend to enter an exclusive union. And if they don't, if imagine a hypothetical situation. This is very hypothetical, but imagine a situation in which two people didn't know that marriage was supposed to be exclusive. They thought that they were able to hook up with whomever they wanted, whatever they wanted. Now, again, very hypothetical situation. But imagine you have two people who no one ever told them that marriage was supposed to be exclusive, right? And they get married. Now, that marriage is invalid. Now, is it either of their fault? No, because they never knew it was exclusive. No one ever told them. The priest should have told them. Their parents should have told them. Society should have told them. But that didn't happen, right? So it's not their fault, per se. It's not like, shame on you. But we would say, but it is invalid, because marriage has to be exclusive.
They wouldn't have said, so that's the reply.
Well, maybe they were just reciting the words that they were told to recite. You know what I mean? Like, and that's the problem, is, you know, people can always claim that, you know. But, so, I mean, the priest could fail to do his job, but at the end of the day, you could have an awful priest doing marriage prep, and the couple could still know what they're getting into and get into it. And on the other side, you could have a priest who's doing his job perfectly, and the couple still doesn't, you know, really intend what they're supposed to intend. But, like, whenever any marriage is done, I mean, the priests are filling out all these forms, and you have to fill out the different forms, you have to ask certain questions. But at the end of the day, this sacrament, the minister of the sacrament, and perhaps this will help answer your question, the minister of the sacrament is the bride and groom themselves. That's part of our sacramental theology, that when a husband and wife get married, yes, the priest or deacon has to be there, and two witnesses have to be there, but the people actually administering the sacrament are the husband and wife, the bride and groom themselves. They are, if you will, conferring the sacrament on the other. And so the priest's part is important to kind of bless this in the name of the church and make sure it's being done validly. But it's not like if I screw something up, this could mess up this. No, so long as the couple, because again, consent makes marriage. So as long as the couple is intending what needs to be intended, then the sacrament occurs. And so long as form is observed and there aren't any impediments, the sacrament occurs. So, does that answer your question, Elizabeth? That's correct.
Yes, okay. So this is kind of going off that. What if the priest says, well, we need this dispensation, but then he doesn't fill out the form? It's
invalid, yeah.
There
you go. That's happened. the priest says, oh, don't worry about that, I'll take care of that form, and then forgets to fill it out and forgets to send it in, and here comes the day of the wedding. That's why you have the vicar general's cell phone, because the vicar general is able to dispense from anything, essentially has all the faculties of the archbishop, and so you would call him up very quickly and he would yell at you immensely, but then he would say, yes, I dispense. And so, and it can be given right over the phone just like that. But if it's not, I mean, that is a good question, it would be invalid. But there are ways to fix that. So, like, for instance, when it's discovered later on, they can issue, I don't want to get too much into this, you'll learn about this in the seminary, but a radical sanation where it's actually a retroactive kind of giving of the faculty. So that could kind of clean things up a little bit. That can... And actually, let me say something about this, too. This is kind of an interesting point along those lines is... It's actually an impediment. So I told you some of the impediments can be dispensed, some of the impediments cannot be dispensed, right? It is an impediment for a Catholic to marry a non-baptized person. So for a Catholic to marry a Jew, a Muslim, an atheist, whomever, it is going to be invalid unless that impediment is dispensed. Now, that impediment is automatically dispensed just for your asking, okay? But technically, it is an impediment. Whereas to marry a Protestant, someone who is baptized but not Catholic, a Protestant, an Orthodox, whomever, that because they are baptized, that there's nothing to be dispensed in that case. You are supposed to contact the bishop and get permission, but again, it's a permission, it's not a dispensation, and so if you don't get the permission, the wedding would be illicit but not invalid, and this is probably much more than you want to know, but there are different degrees. So you can have a wedding that is highly illicit but still valid, you know what I mean, because you didn't get different permissions that you had. Like, for instance, if I do a marriage for someone who's not actually my parishioner, well, that can be illicit because I was supposed to get the permission of the pastor, of their pastor. But I can do it anyways, and without the pastor's permission, it's still valid, it's just illicit, and I would get in trouble and I'd get yelled at, but it's still valid. Same thing if, like, a Catholic and a Protestant get married without getting the bishop's permission, and again, you get the bishop's permission by filling out a form and it goes to the diocese and the bishop doesn't even see it and someone else signs off and permission's granted. But with a non-baptized person, it's actually an impediment that has to be dispensed. But again, it's dispensed automatically just for your asking. So when I have someone who comes before me who's a Catholic marrying a non-baptized person, again, I say, well, this is an extra form I have to fill out, and I submit it to the diocese, and it gets dispensed. But if I forget to fill out that form and the dispensation is not given, then it would be invalid. But again, there are ways to kind of clean that up retroactively. Again, probably much more than you wanted to know. This whole thing, I mean, it can be. Any other question? Yes.
You have to initiate the annulment process in the church where the marriage was.
No. The question was, do you have to initiate the annulment in the church where the marriage occurred? It can be initiated anywhere. It's supposed to be done either in the diocese, the current diocese of the bride or groom. So you can't just go to whatever diocese you want, but I mean, you have to go to the diocese, either the bride or groom's current diocese, or the diocese where it was done, or the diocese where they're now living, or whatever. There are a few different, but any tribunal can do it, but as soon as one tribunal does it, then all other tribunals become incompetent to do it. So. Essentially, because...
So, I guess another part of that is adultery later in the marriage, an invalid reason for adultery?
No. And I got into a little bit of this last month when I talked about just sanctity of marriage in general, but that, you know, when the bond is created, you know, when the couple says, I do, so long as they meant I do, Holy Spirit came upon them, created that bond that only death can get rid of, hence till death do us part. And so even should later on one of them fall into adultery or abuse, begin beating the other person or whatever, none of those things, as awful and as bad as they are, none of those things can destroy the bond, because once the Holy Spirit has created the bond, nothing can get rid of it. Even the couples, even should the couple later on, 20 years later, mutually agree that let's have out, well, you can't do that. The Pope himself can't get rid of it. I mean, what God has joined, no man can set aside. I mean, so that's kind of the point here, is that now, when we see a marriage that has fallen apart and we see those kinds of things, those are often indicators that there were issues earlier on, you know, and you could point to that as you know, well, he didn't start cheating on me until 20 years later, but the fact that he did cheat on me at all might indicate that, you know, this was at least in the back of his mind at the time of the wedding, you know. But in theory, if the wedding was actually valid, if the couple did actually mean I do when they said I do, and then later on fell into whatever else, well, no, that doesn't automatically destroy the bond. I mean, only death can destroy the bond. The Pope can't. The couple themselves can't. Even through a mutual agreement, they couldn't. I mean, Because, and this is why the church makes such a big deal about marriage, because it's a pretty big deal. I mean, when you enter into this, it is that lifelong, you know, until death do us part. So. No.
Well, wait a minute. She can't have two people. That person married, automatically by person married to you, married to the other person. Yet that person not living with you, living with the other person, leaves you out in the middle of nowhere again, right?
Right, but if you're still technically married to that first person.
So then now there are, what do you call them? You have two husbands, two wives?
Well, no, you don't. I mean, and that's. Well, this is. Huh?
Okay, that's like civil law.
Civil law doesn't mean anything. No, it doesn't. Because this is the problem, is you have, let's say you have, I wish I had a chalkboard. I wish I could do like a Glenn Beck kind of thing here and just start drawing things out here. Did you know he's being canceled?
Yeah.
Yeah, I just found out about that. Matt Lady's world is shaking.
Oh, that's very disappointing.
Yeah, I knew you'd be upset. Yeah. But no, so but to answer your question, let's say you have couple A and B, and just for ease of example's sake, we're not going to give them genders or names or anything, but you have A and B. One is male, one is female, okay? A and B are married. A and B gets divorced. A goes off and civilly marries C and is now living happily with C and might have plenty of children with C, right? Well, A and B, at least in the eyes of the church, are still presumed married until proven otherwise. And the fact that they got a civil divorce and the fact that A then ran off with C and got civilly married and has kids and is living happily ever after, we might look at this and say, well, that kind of sucks for B because B is kind of left here and they can't get remarried, and this person's off remarried. Well, number one, this person's not off remarried. This person has attempted marriage. This person is living in sin. And until A and B's marriage, if and until A and B's marriage is annulled, and even once it is annulled, then A and C would have to get their marriage convalidated. They would have to essentially get it done in the church for it to be valid. Then, and only then, is B free to get remarried. So, I mean, I can see the perspective you're looking at it is, oh, well, that kind of sucks for B because B is over here by himself and they can't get married. But technically, A can't either. The fact that A has done that is sin. It's not, huh? Well, yeah, they also go to hell. No, I'm just saying, I mean, it's... Well, no, I mean... Yes, Bill. Yes. Well, to a degree we do, but... When it comes to marriage law, no, not so much. Usually the church tells them that you know, it helps if they are.
But I can see if there's someone who's, say, they're very close to being married, but they're very devout.
Right.
However, there is this situation that you're in.
Mm-hmm.
And, I know a lot of people, I can see where people would hold back from
right.
almost wanting to know,
right.
But I didn't know if you actually had to be civilly divorced.
Some priests would probably tell you to go ahead and get civilly divorced if they think it's going to get annulled. But no, I mean, to answer your question, no, you don't have to be civilly divorced for the annulment to go through. Now, this is the other thing that should be said is, you know, the church tries to get along with society as much as possible. We try to respect, you know, the laws and everything else as much as we can. So, like, for instance, as an ordained priest, I'm also a licensed minister in the state of Maryland and in D.C., right? So when I do a wedding, it is a civil ceremony as well as a religious one. You know, as soon as I do that ceremony, they are married in the eyes of God and in the eyes of the state. It's not like after I do something, they then have to go to the courthouse and get it legitimized. No, I am able to kind of function, if you will, as both an agent of the church and of the state. I'm able to make it so that it's one and the same ceremony. So when we do that, like for instance, we still make them apply for a marriage license. We still make them jump through all the hoops that the state's going to make them jump through, getting blood work done, and I don't think Maryland requires that anymore. But doing those kinds of things, whatever certain states require, the church is still going to say, yes, you should still do that. You know, you still, because we're not trying to go out of our way to tick off the state. You know, you do still need to have. But for instance, this is an example of where the church law supersedes state law. Is, for instance, this has happened in the history of the church, but where certain ethnic groups were prohibited from marrying others by the state law, by a civil government, and the church says, well, we're not going to respect that, and so we have to, you know, the state may not issue a marriage license, but we're going to do a wedding clandestinely, you know. So those kinds of things can happen. Where the state won't issue the marriage license again, but we try to play along as much as we can when it comes to this kind of thing. Yeah.
So the other side of this side of things, when you get known, do you have to go to the divorce, or does the state recognize the annulment?
No. Yeah, the state would still.
Marriage.
No, the state would not.
Okay.
Again, it's two different spheres, really. You would have to get the civil divorce, yeah. Is she saying does an annulment affect the civil status of someone?
Yeah, I would think that an annulment, if you get something annulled, say the marriage becomes fair, I would think that that's...
But the state's going to say, well, you know, as far as we're concerned, you are still married, you know. So, I mean, it works both ways. So the state would still say, no, you still have to get a civil divorce. Because again, there are still legal obligations that have to be respected and everything else. So, yes. Oh.
What if somebody gets married and they want to get married when they get married, but years later they find somebody else they want to marry, so they also kill their spouse and get married to the other person?
They kill their spouse?
Yes.
Well, that would actually be one of those impediments that I read off. That would be the impediment of crime. The impediment of crime cannot be dispensed, I'm pretty sure. Maybe the Pope can. But, yeah, so like certain impediments, like I said, can be dispensed, certain cannot. But no, that would be the impediment of crime. And that's, you know, like, for instance, if that's found out, like, 20 years later, that this person was killed by you, you know, well, then 20 years later, turns out your marriage wasn't valid, you know. Any other questions? Yes. If there is a good reason why the person can't wait the 6 months, and this kind of gets to what I was getting at before, is technically all that has to be done, like canon law does not say that every couple has to meet with the priest 7 times and go to marriage prep and do the NFP class and blah, blah, blah. Those are all requirements that like the diocese or the parish may impose, and with good reason, because those are good things for the couple to go through for marriage prep. But technically, all that has to happen is you have to be able to prove that they are free to marry, meaning that they're not previously married, they're not bound by any impediment. You have to observe canonical form or get dispensed from it if one of the two parties is Catholic. And you have to make sure that they're able to give consent. And a perfect example of when this happens is, you know, this has happened where you have someone who's in the military and they're getting deployed in 4 months. And they say, I want to get married before I get deployed because I don't know if I'm coming back, and I just want to get married and blah, 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 blah. We say, fine, we can work with that, you know. Again, the ideal is to have 6 months to meet with the priest a certain number of times to get to know the priest, for the priest to get to know them. But technically, those things don't have to happen. I mean, because again, when we deal with the sacraments, there's always a certain minimum that just has to happen. The sacraments are inherently simple. They're supposed to be simple. They're supposed to be hard to mess up. So, yeah, they can be, we can work with that. And we've had situations like that. So. Yes.
You mentioned NFP.
Yeah.
And in today's society, there's all kinds of ways of preventing pregnancy.
Mm-hmm.
And so with being open to children as being one of the requirements, what if someone, you know, what if the woman said, you know, the whole idea of having a child scares me to death. I don't know that I'm ready right now. I can't say I'll never be ready, but I don't know if I'm ready right now.
Mm-hmm.
Is that, you know, not
full
consent?
No. Because it's the church has always said that, you know, parents should be responsible in childbearing, you know, and should certainly take into account things like, you know, financially speaking, we can't afford to have a child right now, or, you know, based on where we live, we shouldn't be having children right now, or based on what we're doing with our lives, you know. So the church has always said, you know, parents should be responsible in regulating birth, but you can never use artificial means. That's the problem, is because then you make sex a lie, basically, because this act, which is supposed to be an act of total self-giving, becomes something less than total self-giving. And so nothing is wrong with being able to say, look, we're going to get married now because we want to get married now and we feel called to get married now, but for one reason or another, we can't have kids right away. That's fine. That's not having an intention opposed to it. That's just saying right now we can't. You know, it'd be much different if they said, I, like, never intend to have kids. Yeah. Any more? We're good. And then I'll stick around, so if there are any other questions people want to ask offline.